Good morning, everyone. And I'd like to welcome our delegation. It's lovely to have you here. Lovely. And it's lovely to have all of you lawyers here. And anyone else who may have wandered in. All right. The first case of the day is 11-15-60, Kenseth versus Dean Health Plan. Welcome back. Welcome back.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Lisa Goldman, and I represent the appellant, Deborah Kenseth. This case is about a fiduciary's obligation to produce unambiguous plan procedures and to adequately train customer service representatives, and the correct standard of review is de novo. This Court should reverse the District Court's grant of summary judgment in favor of Dean and instead grant summary judgment in favor of Kenseth for four reasons. First, Dean breached his fiduciary duty to Kenseth by creating an ambiguous plan and procedures when she sought a predetermination of benefits before costs were incurred. Second, Kenseth was both a participant and a beneficiary. At the time Dean's breach, she suffered an actual injury, meaning she has standing to bring this claim and to request equitable relief. Third, the equitable remedies she seeks, including make-whole monetary relief and modifications to Dean plan documents, are viable remedies under the statute and as interpreted by Cigna v. Amara. Fourth, Kenseth is entitled to attorney's fees as she has already obtained some success on the merits and Dean's position was not substantially justified with regard to the breach of fiduciary duty claim.
I'd like to ask you something. Dean says that Ms. Kenseth has yet to pay any of the claims. Have the providers pursued claims against her? And corollary to that would be, would the providers still be within the statute of limitations if they were to sue her? And then if she has not paid up, what would the measure of harm be?
The providers have pursued their claims against her. Some of those are in collections. Some of those are withholding their collection actions, awaiting the conclusion of this case. We have been in communication with many of those collection agencies for those charges. In Wisconsin, on a collection action, the statute of limitations would be 6 years, but it's questionable whether that statute of limitations has been told because of our action in warding off those collection actions while this case is pending. And I forgot your third question.
Oh, is it a wonder? I wondered what you think the measure of harm is if she has not paid up.
The measure of harm is that she would still owe for the services performed, and she's actually, what's not a part of the record, but if I may, she's actually suffered harm already. She can't refinance her house while these cases are pending because there's been some adverse reporting on her credit reporting for some of these charges. So she's actually already suffered some harm, but that's not in the record.
Thank you.
Which brings me to my first point, which is that this Court had already ruled in Kenseth 1 that Dean's conduct in this case would have supported partial summary judgment on a breach of fiduciary duty claim. After this Court remanded the case, Dean did not introduce any new facts countering the basis of this Court's prior opinion.
But Judge Crabb did not find a breach of fiduciary duty, did she?
She did not because she didn't reach that question. She didn't reach that question because she determined Kenseth did not have standing as her employer had changed providers of health insurance, and so she was no longer a member of a Dean plan through her employer.
You know, following up on Judge Tinder's question, what is your best evidence that the plan's breach of fiduciary duty, assuming there was a breach, that it caused the harm? In other words, is there evidence in the record that she would not have had the surgery at the time, or from those providers? I know she testified to that, but or that she had alternate insurance available, which I'm quite certain she probably did not. I mean, because she claims that her husband's insurance contained the same limitation and would not have paid for the surgery either. So,
Your Honor, there are three answers to your question. The first,
yes, no, and maybe.
No. The first is that is it a question of material fact that would have caused Judge Crabb not to be able to grant summary judgment to begin with? Meaning, is it material that the question as to whether or not she could have received the services elsewhere, is that a material fact? And if so, was it improper to grant summary judgment in favor of Dean if they could not show that their facts were undisputed? The facts are undisputed that she could have waited. There's an affidavit in the record from her doctor.
She could have what?
Excuse me?
She could have what?
She could have waited to have had the surgery at another time. There's an affidavit in the record from Dr. Hoopenbecker, the surgeon who performed this procedure, that specifically states, although this was the best remedy for her condition, she could have continued to receive the treatments she had been receiving and had the procedure at another time, because the treatments she had been receiving had been dilations of the site of the band, and they had been curing her symptoms, and they were covered by Dean in the past. Second,
I thought he also said she was just miserable despite those treatments and may pay for the surgery herself. I'm confusing.
You're thinking of a note in the record by Dr. Christensen, and that is not a conclusion of fact. That's a speculative fact, because the note actually says, my guess is that she may, I mean, I'm paraphrasing it, my guess is that she may choose to have the surgery anyway. So it's not a conclusive fact. But more importantly, it's not relevant, because when a fiduciary breaches their duty to a participant, causing them not to be able to make the decision at all, then courts have routinely held that in those circumstances is not relevant. I'd like to draw the court's attention in that particular situation to the Sixth Circuit decision in Crone that was cited by this court in Kenseth 1. And to Martin v. Filer, which is cited in the Department of Labor's brief at footnote 6. The citation is 965 F. 2nd 660, specifically pages 671 and 672, where basically the fiduciary making the argument that if they hadn't breached anyway, everything would have been fine is not an appropriate argument. And that's in Martin v. Filer. Which brings me to my third point, which is that the summary judgment should be granted in favor of Kenseth because the equitable remedies, including a make whole relief or modifications to Dean's plan documents and procedures, are viable remedies under the statute.
But if for summary judgment, there's no question of fact. And this discussion with Dr. Christensen seems to me was at least that was before she made the phone calls, right?
The discussion with Dr. Christensen was before she had consultations with Dr. Hoopenbecker. It was quite some time before. It may have been years before her discussions with Dr. Hoopenbecker to have the surgeries, because she had three or four dilations prior to having the surgery over the course of, I believe, 4 years, but that's in the district court record. I don't have that.
Okay, so you're saying this notation from Dr. Christensen was a long time before she made these calls?
I don't have that in front of me today, but I believe it was a significant amount of time.
It's more than a few days or a week.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
You're talking about years, months?
I believe it's years, but I don't want you to hold me to that. It's in the record. Both notes are in the record from the district court from the beginning. Dr. Christensen was her initial provider, and then she was referred to Dr. Hoopenbecker, who was the expert in this particular type of surgery.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Craig.
May it please the Court, James Craig for the Secretary of Labor, and if possible, I would like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, if that's permitted.
Sure.
Thank you. Cigna versus Amara made clear that make-whole relief is available against ERISA fiduciaries under Section 502A3. Noting that equity suffers not a right to be without a remedy, the court held that make-whole remedies awarded by the Cigna District Court could have been awarded as equitable remedies under Section 502A3. Where a fiduciary breach has occurred, courts have the duty to place the beneficiary in the position he would have occupied had the breach not occurred. And in this case, construing the facts most favorably to Ms. Kenseth, she was misled about whether the surgery that she had was covered, and her injury is obvious in that she became liable to Dean for approximately $78,000 in charges. And we think that equity in this case calls for the straightforward and pragmatic approach, which would be simply to order Dean to take whatever steps are necessary to hold Ms. Kenseth harmless from the medical bills that resulted from the fiduciary breach. Such an order would satisfy the essential prerequisite of placing Ms. Kenseth in the position she would have occupied but for the breach. And also this would give Dean control of the precise method of resolving the problem, which should lead to the most cost-effective approach. Failing to supply a remedy would not only be unfair to Ms. Kenseth, it would undermine the judicial role in regulating fiduciaries, essentially exculpating the fiduciary from responsibility, and leaving open the possibility of allowing Dean affiliates to be unjustly enriched. With respect to the standing issue, I know that that's come up, but we certainly think that the correct rule in standing...
Are the Dean affiliates within the authority of the court in this case?
The fiduciary is within the authority of the court, and it's appropriate to ask the order of the fiduciary to take care of the problem, which was typically done at equity. In equity, many times...
But you're talking about the unjust enrichment of the subsidiary, or the affiliates, I guess.
Well, Dean is certainly responsible for also, as a fiduciary, is responsible for not letting that happen. That's part of their responsibility. They're not supposed to allow a situation to occur where affiliates are unjustly enriched. In fact, there's a Supreme Court case directly on point with this, the Mosser versus Darrow, which held that it's just as much a question of just enrichment or self-dealing, or essentially to permit affiliated companies or their people's friends or family members, directing money to someone with whom you are affiliated is just as much a breach as it would be to receive the proceeds oneself. So the fiduciaries have an independent obligation not to let something like that happen, and they are within the jurisdiction and within the power of the court. With respect to standing, we certainly think that she has standing as she was a participant at the time the breach occurred. This, is, I think, we think consistent with Harzewski, which held that standing under ERISA should be given a broad rather than a narrow construction. It could effectively, in many cases, read 502A3 out of the statute to the extent that participants are no longer with a plan. And it also, a very important point on the standing issue, is that a contrary rule would incentivize fiduciaries to violate ERISA by doing improper things to rid the plan of participants who might sue them. If the question is whether they're a participant now, that would incentivize people to violate various provisions of ERISA, perhaps violating the duties of loyalty.
For one moment, you are remarkable the way you're able to, but could you speak just a little less fast?
I'll try.
Just a little.
I will try.
If you can't, don't. But
thank you. I will try. But certainly it is, we think, would incentivize the fiduciaries to, we don't want to have fiduciaries incentivized to violate ERISA in other ways by a standing rule that essentially would motivate them to do things that violate the duties of loyalty and may violate Section 510 of the statute.
As far as the breach is concerned, you're satisfied with the content of the phone call, I guess, to fully apprise of what's going to take place.
I'm sorry, I didn't...
Whoever the fiduciary answering the phone saying you're covered, they had sufficient notice of what was going to take place.
Well, certainly what was going to take place was certainly within the control of Dean. I mean, Dean, controls the whole situation.
Should have asked more questions, you mean?
Well, Dean has access to the doctors. Dean has access to the hospital. Dean has access to all the medical records. I mean, it's all one company, so they all have access to everything that's within the company. Certainly, if there was a concern about this, they have a responsibility at some level, this is not a case where, the doctor's an independent character somewhere off, who's somewhere else. Maybe there'd be a difficulty with communication. I think that certainly there's factual questions, at a minimum, about that.
One of the problems, of course, is that the person that answered the phone had worked for Dean for, I guess, less than a year. But
which Dean is responsible for training that person. Dean is responsible at some level for monitoring that person, for having procedures in place that permit that make sure that she does her job correctly. So there's certainly Dean is responsible for that.
So her failure, instead of saying, we'll have to check further and call the doctor and all that sort of thing, she shouldn't have just said you're covered.
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I think I'm not really sure about. It's hard
she
to answer that question.
She
wouldn't
have been covered if
she
said that this goes back to the original operation and it's a follow-up for the treating, I guess what they talk. What is it, massive obesity or something like that, mm-hmm. whatever it is.
Well, certainly, you know, Dean certainly had the procedure in the plan. I think the court found in its first opinion had the procedure in the plan that this was what she was supposed to do. The answer she got was the incorrect answer when she called. Again, you know, Dean. One thing, Dean has the
was
control.
Was it the incorrect answer when she called?
The incorrect answer. Dean gave her the incorrect answer when she called. So one of the problems here, too, is that this is a situation where this kind of ambiguity and a process like this that creates this kind of ambiguity, you know, is the situation where if a person becomes liable based upon a situation or scenario like this, one must keep in mind that Dean's affiliates have the ability to get additional income that they otherwise wouldn't be receiving when someone has this happen.
I don't want to sound like a simpleton, but the answer that she got was, you are covered.
Oh, I'm sorry, but apparently that's not the correct answer, though. Apparently that is, according to the documents, the plan documents.
That's the question that we have to answer.
Mm-hmm. Well, the question
is, that's the issue that we have to answer. Was she covered or was she not covered?
Well, apparently the parties have agreed that she was not covered under the plan. She was, however, led to believe that she was covered.
Okay.
So there's a distinction, and that's
the distinction.
That's the distinction here. And that's where the problem came in, that the information was incorrect. And so later on, Dean was able to say, well, actually, Ms. Kenseth, you're not covered. And by the way, you now owe our affiliated company $78,000, which is more than they would have received from the Dean insurance arm itself. Apparently, Ms. Kenseth's brief said that had the surgery been covered, those providers would have received something like $35,000, something in that ballpark. And so instead now she apparently is on the hook for $78,000. So this is a situation, again, where the fiduciary has a responsibility to have a process in place that prevents something like this from happening.
Your 2 minutes just began.
Okay. See, are there any further questions from the court? I could reserve the rest of my time.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Ms. Ratchier, hello again.
Petro here. Nice to see you.
Well,
Judge Tinder.
Thank you.
Judge Mannion. It's a pleasure to be here again this morning. I'm here on behalf of the defendant appellee, Dean Health Plan, Inc., and we're here a second time, as you know, on an ERISA claim being pursued by Deborah Kenseth against Dean. After we were here the first time, this court issued an opinion in which it affirmed the dismissal of two of plaintiff's legal theories, and remanded for further consideration the remaining theory, which was breach of fiduciary duty under ERISA section 502 sub A sub 3. What the remand order said is that the district court upon remand was to let the parties develop what potential relief was being sought under
right.
this specific section and then
right.
determine.
In our first opinion, we set forth a possible breach of fiduciary duty that the plan may have committed, and we framed it in terms of providing Ms. Kenseth with an unclear summary of her coverage benefits, inviting her to call customer service with her questions about coverage, but failing to inform her that the customer service representative did not bind the plan, and failing to advise her what alternative channel she could pursue in order to obtain a definitive explanation or determination, I guess I should say, of coverage in advance for surgery. How would how do you think that breach should have been explained?
How do I think that? I don't think there was a breach to start with.
That alleged breach.
Yes. Your Honor, you said in your summary, and I think the summary was accurate as to the points that the court focused on in its remand decision, you said there was nothing in the plan to tell a caller that she couldn't rely on an oral representation as changing the terms of the plan. I do disagree with that. There was a very distinct provision that said oral representations may not change anything about the plan. They can't increase benefits, decrease benefits, or anything like that. The court noted that provision, which I had brought up probably too many times for your liking the first time around, but did not think it was controlling. But from my perspective, there always was in the plan the written words that said no oral representation can change the terms, the benefits available under this plan.
Where did you preserve this argument about whether she is a participant or beneficiary? Because you seem to be raising it for the first time on appeal.
Not on appeal, Your Honor, but I will tell you it was after remand. So I don't want to mislead the court at all. The court issued a remand order. We went back to the district court.
But why couldn't you have raised the issue in the first appeal?
I think I could have, Your Honor, had I thought to do it. Frankly, my fault. I thought I had a clear winner on breach of fiduciary duty by the elements in reading this court's case law and this court's precedent.
Isn't the argument waived then? Since
I don't know. Well, I don't know that it's waived necessarily, Your Honor, because standing is always something the court has to look at, isn't it? And so I raise the issue. I understand the point that you're making, and it may be a valid point. I don't want to stretch my argument further than the argument goes, but I wanted to raise the issue because I think it's a valid matter of concern. Deborah Kenseth was not a dean subscriber. She was not a dean participant from January 1.
But a lot of judicial ink got spilled getting to the point when you went back on the remand.
And right.
The framework was, I think, pretty well set at that point.
Right. Well, we had, but understand where we came from. We came from three different legal theories with each of their own elements, and we got a summary judgment dismissing all three, and then came to the court the first time, and two, the dismissal was affirmed, one was not in the remand.
What I have been wondering about is who could possibly be a plaintiff under Section 1132, A3 under your interpretation of participant, because a person seeking relief under that section will necessarily not be seeking benefits under the plan, and so we can never that person can never be a participant under your interpretation, and I worry that you know that your interpretation would render that section meaningless.
But my interpretation comes from a decision of this court in 2007 called Harzewski. And it is that decision, which I think I have rendered faithfully, that seems to say that participant status is one who is seeking a benefit from a plan, not seeking relief outside the plan or in addition to the plan, but benefits from the plan. So in bringing up that definition of participant, Harzewski is one of the leading cases on that. But if the court thinks that it would have the unintended effect of eliminating the potential for there being a class of plaintiffs under 502 sub A sub 3, that's something that you have to think about, and particularly now that we have Cigna v. Amara, because that Cigna v. Amara says new stuff about what relief is available under Section 502 sub A sub 3, but doesn't really give us very much to work with. It doesn't discuss Verity. It doesn't discuss Mertens. It doesn't discuss Great West.
Yeah, but it's changed the rules for equitable claims under ERISA. in ways that, you know, we and the district court just didn't anticipate.
Nor I.
Well, none of us are seers into the future.
Right. And one of the problems we have here now is just in forming the sequence of events, and I wanted to answer a question that you had asked Judge Mannion about the timing of the conversation with Dr. Christensen about her being, that is, Deborah Kenseth being so miserable she would pay for the surgery herself. That was at an office visit on November 1, 2005. It was exactly 2 weeks before she made the one and only phone call to the customer helpline, in which she described the surgery she was going to undergo as esophagus revision. 2 weeks.
That's a big difference in what their perception of it is.
I don't think that Ms. Goldman was trying. She was making it very plain that she didn't remember that part of the record precisely. But the sequence was that visit to Dr. Christensen, then a visit to Dr. Huppenbecker, who's going to be the specialist and the surgeon. That was on November 9. Then the call to the customer helpline on November 15, and the surgery was on December 6.
Well, the only reason I raised it is because implicitly in that discussion on the notes of Dr. Christensen is that coverage was part of that discussion, but she doesn't recall any of that.
She doesn't recall it, but she doesn't deny it occurred.
Given that Cigna versus Samara has enlightened all of us as to what relief, equitable relief, could be available, did Judge Crabb address the issues that that she should have in responding to our remand?
Yes, and in defense of Judge Crabb, she was also working from this court's remand decision and from the case law that had gone before. And
given that Cigna changes the dynamics.
But I think it still holds, and for this reason. Judge Crabb said compensatory damages are not equitable relief. Pre-Cigna, she didn't say this because her decision in terms of the timing came out on February 14 of this year. The Cigna decision was issued on May 16 of this year, so just about 3 months after. She didn't frame it, obviously, in that terms because she couldn't see into the future. But she said that compensatory damages are not equitable relief. I think that still holds after Cigna v. Amara. She also said that the statute specifically uses the word, the modifier, appropriate. And when you look at appropriate equitable relief for a breach of fiduciary duty, you have to look at what the breach was and then what it caused. You can't award damages, such as make whole relief, that is disconnected from the breach in the first instance. And here it would be. What I've gathered from this court's first decision is that it feels there wasn't enough in the record to create an allegation, at least, of a breach of fiduciary duty by my client, Dean, because of a communications failure, but not by changing what was covered or not covered. Well, her surgery never was covered. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
And if it were a coverage issue.
But that's not okay.
Well, say if it were coverage issue, then it would have to go through the same process and ultimately decision of the fiduciary and it's arbitrary and capricious, right?
Right. It would be a denial of benefits claims under a different subsection of ERISA. And if you have a denial of benefits claim, then Verity says you can't also have a claim under another subsection.
Look, we set forth a possible breach of fiduciary duty by Dean in our first opinion, as you know. What facts underlying this possible claim are in dispute? I mean, Dean certainly isn't claiming that the summary that was provided to her was unclear. Or, I don't know, is Dean seriously contending contesting that it invited her to, you know, to call customer service to obtain information about coverage, or that Dean failed to tell her how to go about getting a definitive determination of coverage?
I don't dispute that Dean invited subscribers, including Deborah Kenseth, to call the customer helpline. I do dispute, and the record disputes, that all customers, all participants were not warned that oral representations could not override the written terms of the policy, because that's right in the plan. So I do dispute that. And in terms of there being a definitive way of getting a pre-treatment determination, there is none in the plan, but I am aware of no provision of ERISA that requires HMO to have such a provision. It's contrary to the HMO model, and that's really, practically speaking, the reason why it's not there, is because it would create a great deal of cost and difficulty and inefficiency in running the HMO. So, to get back to what happened after the remand, when the record returned to the district court, we quickly had a status conference and new deadlines were set. And Ms. Goldman, on behalf of Deborah Kenseth, was allowed to file a second amended complaint to specifically set forth the type of relief that she believed was both appropriate and equitable. And she named 13 different kinds. Thereafter, the parties moved, cross-moved for summary judgment, and Judge Crabb viewed all of that and issued a decision on February 14, granting Dean's motion.
And then here comes Cigna.
And here comes Cigna. Cigna's a new decision, and for me at least, a frustrating one, because it appears to announce that hereafter claims for appropriate equitable relief against a fiduciary under 502 sub A sub 3 are to be broader than previously thought, but it does not compellingly explain how it reached that conclusion or what it means for the many cases decided not just by this circuit, but by all the circuits that form our Court of Appeals.
Of course, we were under the mistaken impression, and so was Judge Crabb, that she couldn't receive monetary compensation under an equitable theory. We were just, you know, we didn't foresee that.
And the difficulty that I have with Cigna, and I know it is what it is, we're all going to have to deal with it, but it doesn't talk about Mertens in the concurring opinion of Judge Justice Scalia, who says it's pure dicta and nobody has to follow it at all. But he says that Mertens was mentioned once in all of the briefs filed before the Supreme Court for some totally innocuous proposition having nothing to do with equitable relief under 502 sub A sub 3. But that is where we are. The other thing is that the decision in Cigna doesn't even talk about verity, and verity is important to this mix. So I don't envy the court in trying to figure out how to deal with this, because there's not just the Kenseth opinion.
But don't we have to deal with it by remanding?
Well, yes, but does your first decision, Your Honor, no longer stand as law of the case?
I don't know. I don't know. Barbara, what are you going to do?
It was a 65-page decision, Your Honor.
Spread it through every page of those 65.
And in addition, the Department of Labor is asking the court to sua sponte overrule Smith v. Medical Benefits Administrator, which is another decision that this court issued just this year on the same subsection of ERISA. So this is not easy to figure out what's going on here. So then I say to myself, what about Judge Crabb's decision survives Amara? And would hold if Amara had been issued 3 months before rather than 3 months after the district court's decision. And that is her focus on appropriate equitable relief. It is not appropriate equitable relief to provide a remedy that is disconnected from the breach. The breach, if there was one, was a failure of communication. Not enough information was asked of Ms. Kenseth when she called by the dean call operator, and not enough information was provided by Ms. Kenseth, who clearly knew that her upcoming surgery was related to her prior gastric bypass and neglected to mention that. But if there was a failure here, it was a failure of communication. If she is to be put back into the position she was before the breach, she would be back without insurance coverage for the medical treatment she needed in a condition where she is described in the notes and at her own deposition, she agreed that it was an accurate description to say she was very miserable. And she also said that the surgery, which she ultimately had, was very beneficial for her health. So to put her back in the position she would have been before there was this communications problem would have left her in a situation where she needed medical treatment. And to suggest that she should be paid for the medical treatment she received and benefited from, even though it was never covered, there's a disconnect there between what the breach was and what the proposed remedy is. And that's why Judge Crabb focused on the word appropriate equitable relief. It's not appropriate. And this court, when it remanded, suggested, I thought, to Ms. Kenseth ways she could possibly show a monetary damage that might have been recoverable for a breach that consists of a communications failure. And that would be by saying, well, okay, I've researched it and I've looked in Singapore and Taiwan and Fargo, North Dakota, and the surgery there could have been, I could have gotten the surgery and the treatment there for $40,000, not $70,000, and therefore that miscommunication harmed me by the differential. But we had no such proof, and that's why when it came to summary judgment, and it's the plaintiff's burden to prove every essential element of her claim, and there was no such proof, that Judge Crabb said, there's nothing here that gives me something to go with in terms of a monetary remedy from the breach, tied to the actual breach.
So are you saying that Judge Crabb's determination regarding appropriateness or lack of appropriateness could be affirmed?
Yes. Yes, I am.
But how would Ms. Kenseth have known at that time prior to Cigna what to have put forward?
Well, she would have known prior to Cigna because she would have known from reading this court's remand decision, which there's a paragraph in this court's decision towards the end that, I'll paraphrase here, seems to suggest, well, you might have a tough time finding appropriate equitable relief under the standards we understand, but if you could show that there was other treatment available to you in a different way, or you could have gotten it covered in a different way. In terms of coverage, the only policy, the only other insurance policy that was ever made part of the record is the one that provided coverage to Ms. Kenseth's husband through his employment. That policy had the exact same exclusion as the Dean policy, so that was not a viable option. My suggestion of finding lesser cost care elsewhere that would have done the same beneficial work of making her feel a whole lot better might have been a way to at least try to establish. It would have been monetary, but it would have been tied to the breach. And that might have been something that would have given the court a basis for finding that. But it wasn't there, and it's summary judgment, and it's an essential element. So I think that is why Judge Crabb correctly determined that she had to assume there's no proof.
This is goes on remand. All of that proof that you just set out would probably have to be brought in, wouldn't it? If it's remanded, if it goes back to Judge Crabb, you just recited all of the proof that wasn't there. Would she then be able to at least have an opportunity to present that proof, or maybe there isn't any?
I would argue that she should not have that additional time now. When this case was remanded, it was remanded with a very singular focus, and it was to determine if there was any appropriate equitable relief available to Deborah Kenseth under the facts of this case. And really, the paragraph that I'm referencing in the court's decision was pretty much a roadmap. And if there was no proof provided, do you get another chance because a Supreme Court decision is intervened and we're going to go back a third time? I don't think that's fair. I don't think that's appropriate equitable relief, to coin a phrase. And I see the red light is on.
Thank you so very much. So, 2 minutes per side for rebuttal. or rather 2 minutes per
each.
Each for rebuttal.
Rebuttal is always so hard because you have to think. Talk about it on
you
the exact.
Excuse me? You have to think.
Right, exactly. Okay, I have a couple of points to make on rebuttal. First of all, I believe it was Judge Rovner asked a question regarding standing to Dean, and I want to point the court to Massachusetts versus EPA, which is a U.S. Supreme Court decision, 549 U.S. 497, 2007, which specifically states that a litigant who alleges a deprivation of a procedural protection to which he is entitled never has to prove that if he had received the procedure, the substantive result would have been altered. Kenseth is not required to prove that she would have obtained the procedure somewhere else for less because she was denied the procedural protection to have a definitive answer before the costs were incurred. That's Massachusetts versus EPA, 549 U.S., 497. Second, in the prior oral argument in this case several years ago, questions were asked of Dean as to whether or not there was a procedure by which a participant could obtain a binding coverage decision before costs were incurred, and the answer that was given in that argument by Dean was twofold. One, there was already a procedure for doctors to get a binding coverage decision, and if they have a procedure for doctors to get a decision as to whether or not they're going to be paid, they ought to have a procedure for a participant to get a decision as to whether or not they're going to owe the charges. There's no other area in our economy anywhere where you get something and are told later after you get it how much you have to pay for it and that you have to pay for it. It's a basic right that before you have to pay for something, you ought to know you're going to have to pay for it and how much you're going to have to pay for it. And they already have a procedure in place for doctors to get a binding decision before costs are incurred, and there's no reason why they can't implement that procedure for beneficiaries. Moreover, the reasons given by Dean today for not implementing that procedure, specifically the cost would be too great and they would create inefficiency in administering that, no facts are in the record to support that allegation today.
Did the doctor check? Do you know?
The doctor did not check. The doctor gave a standard ambulatory form to Ms. Kenseth that had the list of the procedures she was going to get and told her to call her health insurer to determine whether costs were covered. And she did exactly that, and she told them I was having a Roux-en-Y revision, gastric stenosis, and the customer service representative testified in her deposition she had no idea what that meant, and she wouldn't have known what to say if she had heard that anyway. And Kenseth said she gave this information, and they still told her it was covered, subject to a $300 copay. Fourth, the breach of fiduciary duty in this case caused Kenseth harm, and therefore she additionally has standing. And last, I want to address the issue regarding Cigna and Justice Scalia's concurrence. Cigna had no dissents. It had a majority opinion, and it had a concurrence. And Cigna specifically in the concurrence, which is the support that Dean gave for the argument that surcharge should not be appropriate, specifically Justice Scalia says, equitable estoppel and surcharge are perhaps better suited to the facts of this case. Cigna admits that respondents might be able to recover under 502A3 pursuant to an equitable estoppel theory here, but it presumably makes this concession only because questions of reliance would be individualized and potentially inappropriate for class action treatment. Even
I have to stop you.
Sorry.
I'm sorry, but it just wouldn't be fair.
Oh, that's fine.
It was another. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The appropriateness issue, the Verity argument, that's dealt with essentially by both Verity and Cigna itself. Both of those cases were like this case in the sense that benefits there were also unavailable, but the courts in both of those cases approved A3 remedies. The court approved remedies, and those remedies had a tangential relationship to the benefits that that were not payable under the plan there. So really, those two cases both deal with that. The real key to understanding the appropriateness language in Verity is the word adequate. Verity says where the remedy in some other section is adequate, then an A3 remedy wouldn't be acceptable. But here, the fiduciary breach is a separate kind of harm, and it's because it's a separate harm and it has a separate type of injury, there would be no remedy under A1B. The remedy, therefore, is not adequate. The court in Mondry also reaches a consistent conclusion. their benefits were awarded under A1B, but there was a time value of money issue about the fact that the participant had to pay money out of pocket, money that was continued thus to be held by the plan, and the court in Mondry awarded separate A3 remedy to sort of deal with the part that the part of the injury that wasn't dealt with by A1B. So in the same result is applicable in this case. In addition, with respect to the fact that I think Cigna is pretty clear that compensatory damages or make-whole relief, as we call it, is available under A3. The court is very clear about that. There's a passage at page 1880 of the opinion that talks about how the fiduciary status is what makes all the difference here. In addition, with respect to harmonizing the Cigna decision with the previous law, Mertens and Verity and Great West and all the others, the district court brief, I think, that we filed does have some, hopefully will be helpful in determining how to maybe harmonize those cases. I know that was something that Ms. Rodiger pointed out, but our district court brief would help to sort of show how the rulings are, in fact, consistent, perfectly consistent.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone. Thank you. Thank you. Case will be taken under advisement.